I'm a musician, a writer, I guess I'm a public intellectual. Nearly was a teacher. Nearly went and did English and Media Studies at the University of Institute of Education in the University of London in 1985, but before I intervened. I have two children, I've brought them up through various education systems, so I'm not here as an expert in education, but I'm here as a citizen and a juggler of ideas, fascinated with education. Now, I was asked by Graham to do a tour of the horizon of education technology. I do believe I did say fertile ambivalences of the present. It does sound like one of mine. I don't know how many much Jack Daniels I had at that point, but anyway, probably enough. And I was asked to categorise this horizon by three concepts, two general concepts. One was experience. The other one was pedagogy. Pedagogy, what do you say? Pedagogy in Scotland, right? Pedagogy. Experience, pedagogy, and capabilities. Right. I think I know what I mean by each of these terms, but we may have a discussion about them. And I want to divide the tour of the horizon into kind of hopeful and worrying ambivalences. So I'm going to kind of go through points and talk about hopeful and worrying. And I mean, one of the things that I think is, you know, possibly hopeful about the ubiquity of ICT in the fabric of our everyday lives in the developed West is that we can create a generation of great questioners. You know, that whole scenario where someone's sitting with a reasonably half smartphone, a point of information comes up, you find it in 10 seconds, and then the discussion over the dinner table in the pub is thus enriched, pushed forward. So that we sort of simply presuming that, you know, one of the basic marks on the slate, one of the basic chalk marks on the slate is now the search, is now the ever cleverer search engine. You know, what's the role of education in that environment of ubiquitous facticity, right, or ubiquitous factness, is to help frame those questions, and is to help, you know, inculcate, make it good to be thinking about better questions. Now, what's the worrying dimension of that? I guess that the infosphere becomes so ubiquitous and so attractive and so engaging that kids have no sense of the authority of knowledge, or they have no sense of perceiving what is a method that delivers a fact to me. We also need to be keeping in mind that a lot of the information that may be coming, whether Murdoch keeps his paywall up or not, but the interfaces are mostly delivering information as listed companies under commercial considerations, desperately trying to monetize what I would regard polemically as the dual communism of the way that the internet is constructed anyway. It's an end-to-end network. It came out of the state, and it came out of Tim Berners-Lee's idea that he exchanged knowledge around a lab freely. I mean, this is not Ted Nelson's hypertext where every click costs a penny. This is a different structure. The net we have is a different structure. It's causing reverberations and changes because of the nature of that structure. And so there's a big debate there really about how we actually even perceive the basic structure of the ethos of the internet itself. But let's worry about the interfaces that kids are moving towards in a mixed economy market consumerist society. Let's have a small worry about the information that's coming through those filters and through those platforms. Another fertile ambivalence of the present, on the level of experience, thinking about how we experience this technology. You know, on the hopeful side, maybe there are parents and employers who acknowledge the rate of change that's going on in all occupations, acknowledge the fact that they are learning organisations and that they're constantly updating what they're doing, and they're getting challenges, you know, not just from new technologies but from new cultures, new zones of development in the world, and that they will then look at the school experience, the kind of school experience that's been developed through Curriculum for Excellence, a sense of people having more autonomy about what they do, using things like Learning Teaching Scotland, providing new tools to develop that new autonomous teaching space. Maybe those set of parents will be great about kids being instilled with adaptability and flexibility and all the kind of four trinity of themes and outcomes that the Curriculum for Excellence is kind of based on. I wonder whether those are mostly people like me, kind of freelance portfolio people, you know, who are very, very used to sort of walking into a situation and Batman, Spider-Man, like figuring out with one spidey sense what people need in a certain environment. On the worrying side, what about those parents and employers who judge education and change in survival mode. Now, don't tell me that there's not a lot of people facing the current discourse about endless deficits in Scotland and England and Northern Ireland who aren't in occupational survival mode at the moment. How embracing of any kind of change, whether it's curricular or curricular technology or technological, will this constituency of, you know, not leading industries, a public sector employee is going to be saying when they think about the change or the arguments for change coming out from an education sector who wants to justify the next tranche of spending on an educational infrastructure. Back to basics might be the least of what you hear, you know, in the face of a range of innovations that you might come up with. Why are they playing games with this? Why aren't they getting straight down to that? Why are they footing and messing around in this technologically? Why not just get it? So there's two constituencies, but the friendly to the knowledge society, knowledge dynamism, and the scared of the knowledge design society, knowledge dynamism. It's part of what you have, the landscape you have to deal with. And the other bit of the experience that we're having of an ICT-drenched society and education process. Someone mentioned over there that they went in to give the boy a row for not doing his maths homework, and the boy was sitting with Facebook, Skype, and Messenger, MSN Messenger, solving the problems of that night's maths homework with three or four pals. Okay, and then the parent retreats from that scene. Clearly, you know, there's an example of how kids are embracing cognitive challenges through the stuff that's at their fingertips and through their own processes of wanting to collaborate and make knowledge. But then they go back to school the next morning. You know, and what do they do when they're in that school when they've actually constructed a learning space at home, domestically, in a free space, in a space that they've decorated, that they feel passionate about, that they feel happy in? Go back to school. And I just keep, I can't get away from an old dude in this discussion, which is Ivan Illich. You know the work of Ivan Illich? Deschooling Society, 1970, last chapter, Learning Web. The idea of the city as the classroom, the idea of computers being sedimented in different rooms and workplaces and libraries and streets, and you know, and I, you know, there he is at the cusp of the cyber of the counterculture, dreaming of a future, you know, where all physical spaces could be enchanted for learning. We're here, hello, is here. But the question is, again, there's a kind of worry. Why does it always have to come through the school? You know. Why does it always have to? And again, there's a number of questions there in terms of I'm a teacher, I'm in school, I'm managing these, you know, unruly little humans at certain stages of their imperfect development, you know. But Ivan Illich made that point. You know, maybe we need to think about de-schooling and re-watting. You know, is there actually a different dimension on ICT and education, which is about municipal use of space, municipal use of architecture, you know, civic broadband and civic wireless are being, you know, returning a town or a city or an urbanity or a rurality to maybe an earlier style of learning, but with technological enhancement. Okay, there's experience. Pedagogy. I actually picked up a sneaky wee quote from Learning Teaching Scotland from someone, I can't actually remember the reference, but certainly a high hegian, who said, Glow 2 will be more like a computer game, like a cross between Second Life or the Wii Nintendo. That will be a moving... Is it you?
It's okay. A long time ago.
Okay. It's still there. It's there on a klutzy website. Okay. So it's not properly dated. I'm only using what everybody else is using. Okay. It will be moving between physical and virtual worlds. Now, I don't know. I mean, I love pedagogy. I adore Reggio Emilia. I read Howard Gardner for fun. You know, I'm enjoy the RSAs. You know, endeavors in this area. I mean, it completely grips me. Pedagogy, the whole idea of being able to kind of, you know, devise a philosophy and theory for, you know, developing potential just thrills me as a layman. But I wanted to kind of do a slight hope and worry about something that is certainly on the horizon of ICT in schools, and that's sort of game-based learning. I'm sure that's something that you're all kind of grappling with a bit. Now, you know, on the hopeful side, can't be denied, phenomenon of play and gaming, kids are embracing difficulty. You know, they are competing against each other individually, as teams against each other, against a sense of their own mastery or skill. You know, it's a very powerful new way, a very powerful old revived way of dealing with the world. In fact, extremely old, I did a book called The Play Ethic, which you basically can go as deep as you want and as primevally as you want in terms of defining play in games as how we constitute human society. But I went to a school, some of you might have seen an article that I did in the TES magazine maybe about 6 months ago or something, where I went to a school in New York called Quest to Learn, which was set up by a bunch of games designers, Katie Salen, something called the Institute of Play, and they wanted to look at what kids were doing with games, take that passion and embracing of scaling up learning and embracing levels of difficulty autonomously and joyously, and put some of those learnings into a school, build a curriculum around them, rethink basic educational topics. I mean, just to give you an example, science, maths became the way things work. There was something called Code Worlds, which was to say to kids, English and maths are two codes whereby you construct and intervene in the world, let's consider them jointly. Social studies, history and geography becomes being, space and place. And the quote from Katie Salen was, we are not just using games for the sake of it, we're using it to teach kids that they live in a world of systems and that those systems have to be sustained and in balance. So that's quite a rich worldview or end point for using games in education, is that we live in a very systemic world, whether, I guess, whether that's economic systems or ecological systems or human systems, and we have to get kids to think about that as the object. They're not in the machine-administered, overly bureaucratic society anymore. They're in something that's much more dynamic and flowing and changeable. Here's a great little available paradigm that will help them live in that world. Not in their parents' world or their grandparents' world, but in their world. Hopeful bit. Doubtful bit. Worry bit. I wish I could write this on the board, no, I won't. Anyway, game does not equal play. Okay? Game is a subset of play. Play is deep. Play is, as any parent and early years teachers know, is the mechanism whereby we become capable humans. It's primal. And there are some people in my circle who are worrying about what they call the gamification of everyday life. What does that mean? It means, essentially, that every life activity is an opportunity for points scoring. There's a fantastic presentation by a guy called Jesse Schell, J-E-S-S-E-A-C-H-E-L-L. This is all going on theplayethic.com, you'll be able to refer to it later on. But he did a presentation at a conference about 6 months ago, where he basically presented a kind of combination between 1984 and Super Mario Brothers at the end of his lecture. A world in which you basically move through anything. You brush your teeth, there's an RFID thing in there that signals to your health provider that you're brushing your teeth, you get money off your health service. You know, you buy lots of books on Amazon, you claim that you've read them, you put up summaries, you get money on to your education credit. He basically created this scenario in which omnivorous and omnipotent connectivity turns us all into competitive point scorers in our social environments. Nightmarish, actually. And one of the interesting things, the after school from this Quest to Learn New York Games school had an after school course called Sweat Equity Design Challenge. Quote, remember the last time you got excited about a video game before release? And this was an after school course that was being helped be set up by the games industry in New York to kind of get kids embracing this kind of thinking. Now, I did a games workshop with a very big and illustrious London company called Hide and Seek at the summer, and it was a very dispiriting experience because the process of creating, I don't know if anybody here has done games creating with their students at all, but it proceeds from very, very limited bases of human behaviour. What do you like? What do you hate? Who do you envy? What do you want? Who's your in-group? Who's your out-group? It's an interesting tool to learn about the meaner and cheaper elements of human nature, but it's not the whole story. It's not really, do not overestimate the game-based paradigm as a way of engaging with a generation of young learners. It has its limits, and I speak here as an advocate of play rather than necessarily an advocate of games. And a lot of my recent researchers have been as much in terms of if active learning goes beyond the 6-year-old, 7-year-old, but remember that active learning stroke play has a physical component as well. It's psychosomatic. Let's not presume that kids are being active and playful in the completely healthiest way they can be if they're just engaging statically with a screen. That's simply not what the play scholarship is telling us at the moment. The play is a psychosomatic, full body, cognitive, somatic experience. And if you're invoking it in any of your educational environments, I would suggest that you think more whole humanly about it rather than just getting attracted and allured by the way that games tech is moving through the culture. Okay.